The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 15, Anne's Narrative Resumed. It was on the night of the fancy dress dance that I decided that the time had come for me to confide in someone. So far, I had played a lone hand and rather enjoyed it. Now suddenly everything was changed. I distrusted my own judgment, and for the first time a feeling of loneliness and desolation crept over me. I sat on the edge of my bunk, still in my gypsy dress, and considered the situation. I thought first of Colonel Race. He had seemed to like me. He could be kind, I was sure, and he was no fool. Yet, as I thought it over, I wavered. He was a man of commanding personality. He would take the whole matter out of my hands, and it was my mystery. There were other reasons, too, which I would hardly acknowledge to myself, but which made it inadvisable to confide in Colonel Race. Then I thought of Mrs. Blair. She, too, had been kind to me. I didn't delude myself into the belief that that really meant anything. It was probably a mere whim of the moment. All the same, I had it in my power to interest her. She was a woman who had experienced most of the ordinary sensations of life. I proposed to supply her with an extraordinary one. And I liked her. Liked her ease of manner, her lack of sentimentality, her freedom from any form of affectation. My mind was made up. I decided to seek her out then and there. She would hardly be in bed yet. Then I remembered that I didn't know the number of her cabin. My friend, the night stewardess, would probably know. I rang the bell. After some delay, it was answered by a man. He gave me the information I wanted. Mrs. Blair's cabin was number 71. He apologized for the delay in answering the bell, but explained that he had all the cabins to attend to. "Where's the stewardess, then?" I asked. "They all go off duty at 10 o'clock." "No, I mean the night stewardess." "No stewardess on at night, miss."
But a stewardess came the other night, about 1 o'clock.
"You must have been dreaming, miss. There's no stewardess on duty after 10. He withdrew, and I was left to digest this morsel of information. Who was the woman who'd come to my cabin on the night of the 22nd? My face grew graver as I realized the cunning and audacity of my unknown antagonists. Then, pulling myself together, I left my own cabin and sought that of Mrs. Blair. I knocked at the door.
"Who's that?" called her voice from within.
"It's me, Anne Bedingfeld."
"Oh, come in, gypsy girl."
I entered. A good deal of scattered clothing lay about, and Mrs. Blair herself was draped in one of the loveliest kimonos I had ever seen. It was all orange and gold and black, and made my mouth water to look at it.
"Mrs. Blair," I said abruptly, "I want to tell you the story of my life. That is, if it isn't too late and you won't be bored."
"Not a bit. I always hate going to bed," said Mrs. Blair, her face crinkling into smiles in the delightful way it had.
"And I should love to hear the story of your life. You're a most unusual creature, gypsy girl. Nobody else would think of bursting in on me at 1 a.m. to tell me the story of their life, especially after snubbing my natural curiosity for weeks as you've done. I'm not accustomed to being snubbed. It's been quite a pleasing novelty. Sit down on the sofa and unburden your soul." I told her the whole story. It took some time, as I was conscientious over all the details. She gave a deep sigh when I'd finished, but she didn't say at all what I'd expected her to say. Instead, she looked at me, laughed a little, and said, "Do you know, Anne, you're a very unusual girl. Haven't you ever had qualms?"
"Qualms?" I asked, puzzled.
"Yes, qualms, qualms, qualms. Starting off alone with practically no money, what will you do when you find yourself in a strange country with all your money gone?"
"It's no good bothering about that until it comes.
I've got plenty of money still. The 25 pounds that Mrs. Fleming gave me is practically intact. And then I won the sweep yesterday. That's another 15 pounds. Why, I've got lots of money. 40 pounds. Lots of money. My God, murmured Mrs. Blair. I couldn't do it, Anne. And I've got plenty of pluck in my own way. I couldn't start off gaily with a few pounds in my pocket and no idea as to what I was doing and where I was going. But that's the fun of it, I cried, thoroughly roused. It gives one such a splendid feeling of adventure. She looked at me, nodded once or twice, and then smiled. Lucky Anne. There aren't many people in the world who feel as you do. Well, I said impatiently, what do you think of it all, Mrs. Blair? I think it's the most thrilling thing I ever heard. Now, to begin with, you'll stop calling me Mrs. Blair. Suzanne will be ever so much better. Is that agreed? I should love it, Suzanne. Good girl. Now, let's get down to business. You say that in Sir Eustace's secretary, not that long-faced Paget, the other one, you recognized the man who was stabbed and came into your cabin for shelter. I nodded. That gives us two links connecting Sir Eustace with the tangle. The woman was murdered in his house, and it's his secretary who gets stabbed at the mystic hour of 1 o'clock. I don't suspect Sir Eustace himself, but it can't be all coincidence. There's a connection somewhere, even if he himself is unaware of it. Then, there's the queer business of the stewardess, she continued thoughtfully. What was she like? I hardly noticed her. I was so excited and strung up, and a stewardess seemed such an anticlimax. But, yes, I did think her face was familiar. Of course it would be if I'd seen her about the ship. Her face seemed familiar to you, said Suzanne. Sure she wasn't a man? She was very tall, I admitted. Hardly Sir Eustace, I should think, nor Mr. Paget. Wait. She caught up a scrap of paper and began drawing feverishly. She inspected the result with her head poised on one side. A very good likeness of Reverend Edward Chichester. Now, for the et ceteris. She passed the paper over to me. Is that your stewardess? Why, yes, I cried. Suzanne, how clever of you. She disdained the compliment with a light gesture. I've always had suspicions of that Chichester creature. Do you remember how he dropped his coffee cup and turned a sickly green when we were discussing Crippen the other day? And he tried to get Cabin 17. Yes, it all fits in so far. But what does it all mean? What was really meant to happen at 1 o'clock in Cabin 17? It can't be the stabbing of the secretary. There would be no point in timing that for a special hour on a special day, in a special place. No, it must have been some kind of appointment, and he was on his way to keep it when they knifed him. But who was the appointment with? Certainly not with you. It might have been with Chichester, or it might have been with Paget. That seems unlikely, I objected. They can see each other any time. We both sat silent for a minute or two. Then Suzanne started off on another tack. Could there have been anything hidden in the cabin? That seems more probable, I agreed. It would explain my things being ransacked the other morning. But there was nothing hidden there, I'm sure of it. The young man couldn't have slipped something into a drawer the night before. I shook my head. I should have seen him. Could it have been your precious piece of paper they were looking for? It might have been, but it seems rather senseless. It was only a time and a date, and they were both passed by then. Suzanne nodded. That's so, of course. No, it wasn't the paper. By the way, have you got it with you? I'd rather like to see it. I had brought the paper with me as Exhibit A, and I handed it over to her. She scrutinized it, frowning. There's a dot after the 17. Why isn't there a dot after the one, too?
There's a space, I pointed out.
Yes, there's a space, but...
Suddenly she rose and peered at the paper, holding it as close under the light as possible. There was a repressed excitement in her manner.
Anne, that isn't a dot. That's a flaw in the paper. A flaw in the paper, you see? So you've got to ignore it and just go by the spaces. The spaces!
I had risen and was standing by her. I read out the figures as I now saw them. 1, 71, 22.
You see, said Suzanne, it's the same, but not quite. It's 1 o'clock still, and the 22nd, but it's cabin 71. My cabin, Anne.
We stood staring at each other, so pleased with our new discovery and so wrapped with excitement that you might have thought we'd solved the whole mystery. Then I fell to earth with a bump.
But Suzanne, nothing happened here at 1 o'clock on the 22nd.
Her face fell also.
No, it didn't.
Another idea struck me. This isn't your own cabin, is it, Suzanne? I mean, not the one you originally booked.
No, the purser changed me into it.
I wonder if it was booked before sailing for someone, someone who didn't turn up.
I suppose we could find out.
We don't need to find out, gypsy girl, cried Suzanne.
I know. The purser was telling me about it. The cabin was booked in the name of Mrs. Gray, but it seems that Mrs. Gray was merely a pseudonym for the famous Madame Nadina. She's a celebrated Russian dancer, you know. She's never appeared in London, but Paris has been quite mad about her. She had a terrific success there all through the war. A thoroughly bad lot, I believe, but most attractive. The purser expressed his regrets that she wasn't on board in a most heartfelt fashion when he gave me her cabin, and then Colonel Race told me a lot about her. It seems there were very queer stories afloat in Paris. She was suspected of espionage, but they couldn't prove anything. I rather fancy Colonel Race was over there simply on that account. He's told me some very interesting things. There was a regular organized gang, not German in origin at all. In fact, the head of it, a man always referred to as the Colonel, was thought to be an Englishman, but they never got any clue as to his identity. But there's no doubt that he controlled a considerable organization of international crooks. Robberies, espionages, assaults, he undertook them all, and usually provided an innocent scapegoat to pay the penalty. Diabolically clever he must have been. This woman was supposed to be one of his agents, but they couldn't get hold of anything to go upon. Yes, Anne, we're on the right tack. Nadina is just the woman to be mixed up in this business. The appointment on the morning of the 22nd was with her in this cabin. But where is she?
Why didn't she sail?
A light flashed upon me.
She meant to sail, I said slowly.
Then why didn't she?
Because she was dead. Suzanne, Nadina was the woman murdered at Marlowe. My mind went back to the bare room in the empty house, and there swept over me again that indefinable sensation of menace and evil. With it came the memory of the falling pencil and the discovery of the roll of films. A roll of films. That struck a more recent note. Where had I heard of a roll of films? And why did I connect that thought with Mrs. Blair? Suddenly I flew at her and almost shook her in my excitement.
Your films! The ones that were passed to you through the ventilator. Wasn't that on the 22nd?
The ones I lost?
How do you know they were the same?
Why would anyone return them to you that way, in the middle of the night? It's a mad idea.
No, they were a message. The films had been taken out of the yellow tin case and something else put inside. Have you got it still? I may have used it. No, here it is. I remember I tossed it into the rack at the side of the bunk. She held it out to me. It was an ordinary round tin cylinder, such as films are packed in for the tropics. I took it with trembling hand. But even as I did so, my heart leapt. It was noticeably heavier than it should have been. With shaking fingers, I peeled off the strip of adhesive plaster that kept it airtight. I pulled off the lid, and a stream of dull, glassy pebbles rolled onto the bed. "Pebbles," I said, keenly disappointed. "Pebbles?" cried Suzanne. The ring in her voice excited me. "Pebbles? No, Anne, not pebbles. Diamonds." Chapter 15. Diamonds. I stared fascinated at the glassy heap on the bunk. I picked up one, which but for the weight might have been a fragment of broken bottle. "Are you sure, Suzanne?" "Oh, yes, my dear. I've seen rough diamonds too often to have any doubts. They're beauties too, Anne, and some of them are unique, I should say. There's a history behind these." "The history we heard tonight," I cried. "You mean Colonel Race's story? It can't be a coincidence. He told it for a purpose." "To see its effect, you mean?" I nodded. "Its effect on Sir Eustace?" "Yes." But even as I said it, a doubt assailed me. Was it Sir Eustace who'd been subjected to a test, or had the story been told for my benefit? I remembered the impression I had received on that former night of having been deliberately pumped. For some reason or other, Colonel Race was suspicious. But where did he come in? What possible connection could he have with the affair? "Who is Colonel Race?" I asked. "That's rather a question," said Suzanne. "He's pretty well known as a big game hunter. And as you heard him say tonight, he was a distant cousin of Sir Lawrence Eardsley. I've never actually met him until this trip. He journeys to and from Africa a good deal. There's a general idea that he does Secret Service work. I don't know whether it's true or not. He's certainly rather a mysterious creature." "I suppose he came into a lot of money as Sir Lawrence Eardsley's heir." "My dear Anne, he must be rolling. You know, he'd be a splendid match for you." "I can't have a good go at him with you aboard the ship," I said, laughing. "Oh, these married women." "We do have a pull," murmured Suzanne complacently. "And everybody knows that I'm absolutely devoted to Clarence, my husband, you know. It's so safe and pleasant to make love to a devoted wife. It must be very nice for Clarence to be married to someone like you." "Well, I'm wearing to live with. Still, he can always escape to the Foreign Office, where he fixes his eyeglass in his eye and goes to sleep in a big armchair. We might cable him to tell us all he knows about Race. I love sending cables, and they annoy Clarence so. He always says a letter would have done as well. I don't suppose he'd tell us anything, though. He's so frightfully discreet. That's what makes him so hard to live with for long on end. But let us go on with our matchmaking. I'm sure Colonel Race is very attracted to you, Anne. Give him a couple of glances from those wicked eyes of yours, and the deed is done. Everyone gets engaged on board ship. There's nothing else to do." "I don't want to get married." "Don't you?" said Suzanne. "Why not? I love being married, even to Clarence." I disdained her flippancy. "What I want to know is," I said with determination, "what has Colonel Race got to do with this? He's in it somewhere. You don't think it was mere chance, his telling that story?" "No, I don't," I said decidedly. "He was watching us all narrowly. You remember, some of the diamonds were recovered, not all. Perhaps these are the missing ones. Or perhaps..." "Perhaps what?" I didn't answer directly. I should like to know, I said, what became of the other young man? Not Eardsley, but what was his name? Lucas. We're getting some light on the thing anyway. It's the diamonds all these people are after. It must have been to obtain possession of the diamonds that the man in the brown suit killed Nadina. He didn't kill her, I said sharply. Of course he killed her. Who else could have done so? I don't know, but I'm sure he didn't kill her. He went into that house 3 minutes after her and came out as white as a sheet. Because he found her dead. But nobody else went in. Then the murderer was in the house already, or else he got in some other way. There's no need for him to pass the lodge. He could have climbed over the wall. Suzanne glanced at me sharply. The man in the brown suit, she mused. Who was he, I wonder? Anyway, he was identical with the doctor in the tube. He would have had time to remove his makeup and follow the woman to Marlowe. She and Carton were to have met there. They both had an order to view the same house, and if they took such elaborate precautions to make their meeting appear accidental, they must have suspected they were being followed. All the same, Carton did not know that his shadower was the man in the brown suit. When he recognized him, the shock was so great that he lost his head completely and stepped back onto the line. That all seems pretty clear, don't you think so, Anne? I didn't reply. Yes, that's how it was. He took the paper from the dead man, and in his hurry to get away, he dropped it. Then he followed the woman to Marlowe. What did he do when he left there? When he had killed her, or, according to you, found her dead? Where did he go? Still, I said nothing. I wonder now, said Suzanne musingly, is it possible that he induced Sir Eustace Pedler to bring him on board as his secretary? It would be a unique chance of getting safely out of England and dodging the hue and cry. But how did he square Sir Eustace? It looks as though he had some hold over him. Or over Paget, I suggested in spite of myself. You don't seem to like Paget, Anne. Sir Eustace says he's a most capable and hard-working young man, and really, he may be, for all we know, against him. Well, to continue my surmises, Raeburn is the man in the brown suit. He had read the paper he dropped. Therefore, misled by the dot, as you were, he attempts to reach Cabin 17 at 1 o'clock on the 22nd. Having previously tried to get possession of the cabin through Paget. On the way there, somebody knifes him. Who? I interpolated. Chichester. Yes, it all fits in. Cable to Lord Nasby that you have found the man in the brown suit, and your fortune's made, Anne. There are several things you've overlooked. What things? Raeburn's got a scar, I know. But a scar can be faked easily enough. He's the right height and build. What's the description of a head with which you pulverize them at Scotland Yard? I trembled. Suzanne was a well-educated, well-read woman, but I prayed that she might not be conversant with technical terms of anthropology. Dolichocephalic, I said lightly. Suzanne looked doubtful. Was that it? Yes. Long-headed, you know. A head whose width is less than 75% of its length, I explained fluently. There was a pause. I was just beginning to breathe freely when Suzanne said suddenly, "What's the opposite?" "What do you mean, the opposite?" "Well, there must be an opposite. What do you call the heads whose breadth is more than 75% of their length?" "Brachycephalic," I murmured unwillingly. "That's it. I thought that was what you said." "Did I? It was a slip of the tongue. I meant dolichocephalic," I said with all the assurance I could muster. Suzanne looked at me searchingly. Then she laughed. "You lie very well, gypsy girl. but it will save time and trouble now if you tell me all about it."
"There's nothing to tell," I said unwillingly.
"Isn't there?" said Suzanne gently.
"I suppose I shall have to tell you," I said slowly. "I'm not ashamed of it. You can't be ashamed of something that just happens to you. That's what he did. He was detestable, rude and ungrateful. But that I think I understand. It's like a dog that's been chained up or badly treated. It'll bite anybody. That's what he was like, bitter and snarling. I don't know why I care, but I do. I care horribly. Just seeing him has turned my whole life upside down. I love him. I want him. I'll walk all over Africa barefoot till I find him, and I'll make him care for me. I'd die for him. I'd work for him, slave for him, steal for him, even beg or borrow for him. There, now you know."
Suzanne looked at me for a long time.
"You're very un-English, gypsy girl," she said at last. "There's not a scrap of the sentimental about you. I've never met anyone who is at once so practical and so passionate. I shall never care for anyone like that, mercifully for me. And yet I envy you, gypsy girl. It's something to be able to care. Most people can't. But what a mercy for your little doctor man that you didn't marry him. He doesn't sound at all the sort of individual who would enjoy keeping high explosive in the house. So there's to be no cabling to Lord Nasby." I shook my head.
"And yet, you believe him to be innocent."
"I also believe that innocent people can be hanged."
Yes. But Anne, dear, you can face facts. Face them now. In spite of all you say, he may have murdered this woman."
"No," I said, "he didn't."
"That's sentiment."
"No, it isn't. He might have killed her. He may even have followed her there with the idea in his mind, but he wouldn't take a bit of black cord and strangle her with it. If he'd done it, he would have strangled her with his bare hands."
Suzanne gave a little shiver. Her eyes narrowed appreciatively.
Anne, I'm beginning to see why you find this young man of yours so attractive.